Welcome to the Polymer Science Podcast. I am Dr. Alicia Buertes.
And I'm Jacob Schechtman.
In this podcast, we'll be speaking to researchers from around the world and talk to them about how their work is improving our daily lives. I hope you enjoy our conversation and that you learn something new.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Polymer Science Podcast. In today's episode, we hear a candid and enlightened conversation with Professor James Rollins. Dr. Rollins has been a professor here at the University of Southern Mississippi since 2004, focusing his research efforts on the structure property and structure performance relationships of polymer coatings. Tune in now to learn more about the polymer coatings we see and use every day.
So my name is James Rollins, and I grew up on the coast of Mississippi in the U.S., and graduated high school there, and then ended up in Texas for a few years with a lawn care company that my father and I started. And then I came to Southern Miss to get a degree in polymer science. At the end of my bachelor's degree, I realized I only knew enough to know I didn't know anything. And so I decided to get a PhD. And when I finished that, I went to work for a small startup company. It was about 10 or 11 people, depending on if the boss was happy that day or not. And some days that meant I was doing science, and some days that meant I was shrink wrapping pallets of paint to ship out the door, that sort of thing. About a year into that, I found out I was going to have a son, and knew that the 70-plus hour work weeks didn't mean for much time with my son. And simultaneously, a gentleman, Dr. Doug Wicks, offered me a position with Bayer in Germany. He offered me the position in Pittsburgh, PA, and I worked there for 2 years. And then when I finished that stint, I went 2 years to Leverkusen, Germany, and worked at the headquarters for what's now Covestro.
You said you went into polymer science for undergrad, yeah?
Yeah.
How did you know what polymer science was at that time?
So it's all by accident, and I'm going to say thankfully so. It was a nice serendipitous trail. I was mowing lawns in Texas, and I had a best friend from grade school that was at Southern Miss, and he was in computer science and electronics engineering. He had a friend who tried to be in polymer science here at Southern Miss and had not made the cut, basically. And while I was mowing lawns, he said, you know, you could come to the polymer science program here at Southern Miss, and then you could be my roommate. I said, well, I'll check into it. So I made a few phone calls and talked to, at the time, there was a gentleman named Sammy Pace that ran all of the undergraduate laboratories. He even ran the graduate laboratories at that time. And so Sammy was full-time salaried employee, and that was his job, run the laboratories. And I talked to him, and he says, well, come out and visit. You know, it was a real hospitable Southern Mississippi thing. Come visit. So I came over and kind of interviewed the program. And, of course, I hadn't been in school for 2 years. So there's a little bit of shock associated with doing organic chemistry and mechanisms in organic chemistry. But it took me a little while, but I got up to speed. So
in class, obviously, you've given examples of how you fixed that. There was that Mustang or something. You fixed the flooring, right?
Yeah.
You've got all these different examples of working with polymeric materials, it seems like, before you even came into the program. Were you aware of polymers as a growing field at the time?
I don't think I could have articulated it in words. So I did a good bit of fiberglass work and Bondo and body work, which is almost all, you know, free radical cured chemistries. But I wouldn't have known that then. I just knew Bondo for this and fiberglass and get some polystyrene resin for that. But I grew up working on cars, so I've always worked on cars. And there's my wife has put a sign in my office that says, a car mechanic that fell in love with chemistry. So, it's kind of just intuitive. I think lots of people gravitate towards science because they like solving problems, and they keep looking for problems that are more and more difficult to solve. And it's kind of the fun and the brain teaser that we live with daily. So, yeah, I can look back on the fiberglass floor that I rebuilt, basically like a boat, the bottom of a boat, but in a 73 Mach 1. And I look back on it and I wonder what the molecular weight was and what the cross-link density was, but obviously I didn't have a clue. I just know that I put a lot of initiator in there, and it was probably too much initiator in there, so it was probably too low a molecular weight. But it held up until I sold the car, so then I cringe every once in a while, like, what did I do to that next person that had to ride in that car?
So, all right, and so tell me about your graduate school experience.
Well, I stayed in Hattiesburg and went straight into the graduate program after, I think, maybe 3 days off the entire summer because I was trying to finish up my actual undergraduate research, and then started my first year. Immediately, it was a big class. I think there were 23 or 24 of us that year. It was a big class. I couldn't believe, and this is one of those anomalies, I guess. I didn't even realize when I applied for grad school that we got paid to go to grad school. And so this check shows up, you know, sometime in probably October. I'm like, wow, we're learning. They're paying us to learn, and we get to learn all we want. And so I really took it to heart and started trying to learn all I could about everything around me. But the first year went quite well. I decided to go to work for Dr. Shelby Timms. He was the founder of the program, but also he was my undergraduate advisor. And I liked the kind of the style and the rhythm of how he worked. He just really wanted to solve problems as well. Mm-hmm. So that had big appeal. He liked to make things and break things. He would say that, you know. So, and to do that and then to understand why is to put the science behind it. And, of course, to be able to calculate it and measure it was the engineering part of it. It was a lot of fun. My dissertation project was focused on UV curable powder coatings. So the goal was there is to kind of separate the flow and leveling part of powder coatings and the curing part to two distinctly separate processes. And it was a lot of fun.
Can you, to someone who's never even heard of polymers, describe the powder coating process?
Yeah, I think everybody's probably handled powdered sugar as opposed to granulated sugar. And powdered sugar has that really, really fine, small particle size fineness to it. Powder coatings are a lot like that in at least the size range. And they flow easily when you put a little compressed dry air in it, like you would for air hockey table, where you put the air through the table and it kind of floats the puck. Mm-hmm. When that happens, the powder kind of flows, and it flows like a liquid because they're in the main mostly spherical or partially spherical, and they'll kind of roll around and move, and then you kind of siphon off of that powderized version of it and electrostatically drive it to most often metal substrates. There's some non-metal applications, but... And then you take those substrates, and with that electrostatic attraction, it will hold it actually with some affinity so that you can handle it lightly and then even get it to a cure oven.
So, mm-hmm. So you've been doing polymer coatings for about as long as you've been studying polymer science, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So can you, in the class that we just took with you, one of the amazing things and pretty much that you showed us from the beginning is you got this mind map. And if people don't know what a mind map is, you guys should look that up. Good organizational tool. But it's showing the complexity of thought that has to go into preparing, manufacturing a polymer coating. Can you put a little bit of insight into that? Like what different fields of science are you finding yourself reaching toward to put together, we'll just stick with the lacrosse stick, right? Okay. Or my co-host, she used to play field hockey. So maybe a field hockey stick, whether it's wood or composite. What goes into coating something like that kind of material?
Yeah, so you have this constant kind of cyclical in the mind map. You're connecting everything back and forth. And almost every discipline I've ever touched on or learned from or tapped into goes into making a practical coating. So I want to put a couple base level thoughts together. So, you know, everybody's purchased, I don't know, a bag of M&Ms or something. You got to think about what's in it. And I'm a little partial to peanut M&Ms. So you get the peanut, you get the chocolate covering, then you get the coating that goes on the outside. And that coating had a purpose, right? It was supposed to kind of be sufficiently high TG for the polymer world, or sufficiently hard so that it didn't really melt in your hand, but it melted in your mouth kind of thing. I mean, that was the concept. But you think about, you could draw upon lots of different coatings and lots of different chocolates, and you could get various sized peanuts or things like that. So you take a coating and you've got these same basic raw materials, but you've, you know, in essence, you probably have about 60,000 options on the table. And then you start to put that together. And the order with which you put those together, how you process that set of raw materials, even if the same raw materials but processed two or three different ways, creates slightly different variations in the results, like the viscosity and the rheology. And so what's amazing is we do all that. We blend these raw materials together, and then we end up with something that you can, you know, go to a store and buy for, you know, $36 a gallon. And you can coat any of, you know, 10 or 15 different substrates and have something that performs quite well to do its function for, you know, anywhere between 1 to 20 years, depending on what you coat with it. So it's pretty phenomenal. But you, in that process, you're taking something that's most often a liquid. We've already touched on powder coatings. They're not. They're solids that then become liquids when you heat them in the oven and cure to become another solid. But most liquid paints are liquids. They're liquids so that they have that ease of applicability. They can conform to the substrate. The thing that a lot of people don't realize until they start to talk about the science of it is that, you know, coatings are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. They're in every facet of our lives. They're on everything we touch. They're, you know, protecting everything we own. They're, you know, and of course the two cars bump into each other, and they aren't always designed for that level of impact. Or you scratch it with your key, or the kids run down the halls and they run their hands down the hallways and they change the gloss level, or they put dirty handprints on there, or that sort of thing. Carpets coated, the ceilings above us and around us are coated for various reasons. Sometimes you have a, you know, it's just an aesthetic component to give you the color. Sometimes it's to give you color and topography and maybe even an antimicrobial aspect, or even sound deadening. And there are paints and coatings out there that clean the air, that, you know, inherently are giving off free radicals at low levels that are designed to do that, to make air more and more purified. There are coatings that we put on pills to really kind of control the rate with which we get dissolution in the stomach so that we can skip that process and maybe deliver the active pharmaceutical agent to a different portion of the body, that sort of thing. Or maybe even just buffer it to keep from having a pH response that's too drastic. So when people tune into it, you know, often people think in terms of houses or planes, trains, and automobiles are all painted. But when you get, not to be too punny, but when you get past that, you kind of peel back the surface of it, you start to realize there's layers and layers of technology there that are delivering an incredible amount of value add. So a typical coating would be 1% to 2% of the cost of any asset or object you buy. And yet, without those coatings, some of those assets might have a truncated life that could be as much as 1/100th of their lifetime. And we're talking about, you know, 1 or 2% of the cost of it is giving you the ability to use it for 100 months instead of 1 month in certain environmental conditions. So it's pretty incredible. And then the market has the coatings technology and the coatings markets have a complete dichotomy or bimodal distribution, because you have some technologies that are completely commoditized. You know, we've painted the side of a barn red for 3,000 or 4,000 years, right? We've done that, and we just continue to do that, and we've improved upon it dramatically. We kind of take for granted that started in some rudimentary processing facility where we took peanut oil or linseed oil and kind of ground it with the remnants of black charcoal from the fire, and we maybe even red iron oxide from the ground that's kind of just rust, we would think of it now, but we create an amber or red or something like that, and then we paint that, and that lets that wood last through the lifetime of that farmer's barn. Whereas without it, that wood would rot and decay. So it's pretty amazing. The other side of the bimodal distribution is we have things that aren't commodities at all, that are really high level required. You know, they filter light, they maybe even upshift and convert light to other frequencies. And we have things that are used in electronic applications that would filter or protect. We have there's even groups out there that try to put things almost like a DNA type code into the coating so that those materials could be identified and you'd know what the root source was later if you looked at it. And they're not DNA, but they're kind of, how can we identify what date, what time, what polymeric material, what crosslinker we were involved with Department of Defense at one point, and they said, you know, how do we know who painted this on what date 4 years from now?
Yeah.
And so people have made attempts at things like that. It's crazy. And yet you can do those things. If you think about like ski lift tickets, you print them on demand, you print them on the spot, you use them for a couple of days. A lot of people don't realize that that is a series of acid and base acceptor donor complexes that are colorless until you thermally hit them. And then the whole goal from their perspective is have something they can print that you can carry with you, that they can stick on you, that stays on your person or your jacket. You ski for a day or two, whatever, and then it fades, so you can't cheat the system, right? You can't come back with that lift ticket perpetually. And so, I mean, these technologies are incredible, but yet you buy them by the gallon at any store. The ceiling paint, if you haven't used it before, I suggest everybody get at least a quart of it and play with it. But there's a ceiling paint out there that has an acid base complex that is one part of it's volatile so that it's pink. So it's white ceiling paint, but when you paint it on, it's pink. And then as the base, the amine, volatilizes, it becomes white. But it's because it's the hardest problem when you paint something above your head, and most often the lights are shining down in your face, is you can't tell the overlap lines. Mm-hmm. So they make it pink so you can see the pink as you paint across, but the pink fades to give way to white. But because you could see the pink and differentiate between the white that's already there,
gotcha,
you don't end up with a little bitty thin streak somewhere that you missed and you can't see until you shine a flashlight or some other light that's upward facing. Just simple, simple technology. That color shift capability's been around as a technology probably since the late 40s, early 50s. It's only in the last maybe 15 years that somebody really perfected it, put it in a gallon of paint, and now you can buy ceiling paint that's pink. And everybody looks at it and goes, I don't want pink ceilings. But once it fades, you're like, wow, that made it really easy to paint.
So is with that specific example, is most ceiling paint made with that sort of idea in mind? It's some color changing tech that's just easier to see when you're looking up?
Well, I wouldn't say most. I think there's a couple of trade names out there, and I'm not remembering any of them specifically, but it really does make it easy to get a white ceiling well done. You know, a lot of other interior designers, of course, are going to specify what they want. So what I've never seen is that you could drop that technology into any gallon of paint, right? Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that. So whoever did it spent some energy doing their kind of due diligence and making sure they own that part of the market. But
interesting. Oh, I see. So you're saying it could be just so thoroughly patented and protected right now.
I suspect because of the age of it, it probably isn't patented, but it probably is, you know, a trade secret. Coatings are filled with examples like that. You know, people don't worry too much about the odor of paint initially, like when they first start painting. But a big trend over the last 20 years has been, how can I make zero VOC house paint so that I can paint, you know, room number one and not have room number 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 filled with these kind of obnoxious fumes that I don't want to smell for a week. Maybe around 2000, 2002, 3 or 4, right in there, people started developing what are called zero VOC systems. So you could paint in a room and not even have to empty out the rest of the office, and almost no odor. So I won't say they're odorless, but there's 5 or 6 technologies out there that are so low in odor that you could paint an entire gymnasium and not offend anybody with some obnoxious odor. And I know everybody's sensitivity is different, but you know, the common practice, like I'll give you a good example. Common practice, if we're going to paint a Navy ship on the inside, is you dock the ship. Not, you don't have to dry dock it, but you dock the ship. You empty it completely out. You disconnect everything that's electrical, right, for flash hazard. And then you paint the ship with solvent-based technology from the 40s and 50s. That would have been protocol 30 years ago. And they would do this once every 3 or 4 years. They paint the entire ship. But nobody's allowed on the ship, and nobody can use the ship, and nobody can be in proximity to the ship. And even the painters are having to wear positive pressure and supply oxygen because you're in this closed vessel painting with solvent-based paints. Well, now we have water-based paints that'll clean up with, you know, warm water that have almost no odor, and the ship's fully functioning. Even you can even do it at sea while you're in mission. You can be painting a room and nobody's has to leave. So same thing. We used to close schools down. Part of the reason we closed schools down in the summer at different points in time were if we're going to ever do maintenance on the school, we need all the kids and all the teachers out. Mm-hmm. Well, now that's not a need. I mean, you can paint every office in the hall and just keep moving people back in. And so technology's evolved. It's incredible. If you think about here, I have this little, I mean, it's almost like buying a cup of coffee. You can buy paint in any corner store, anywhere in the world with varying degrees of technology, obviously, but you can buy some incredibly high performing polymer science in a can and not even think twice about, I painted this and now I'm going to pass this on to my kids or my grandkids or something like that. And yet you do with furniture and mm-hmm. objects like that all the time.
Yeah, I love that thought of just any person picking up this can of high performance polymers, right? Yeah. And it's just a can of paint. But yeah. the thought and science and problem solving that went into making that, it's incredible. Can you talk more about specific examples like the painting of the Navy ships or the gymnasium here at school that you guys did the flooring for? Yeah. What as a unit of USM have you guys also contributed to in terms of providing coating products?
There's a couple of commercial examples that were really important. Shelby Thames at one point had kind of married two technology platforms. You know, we've been making successfully, to varying degrees, acrylic latexes and styrene vinyl acetate latexes since the, I'd say, mid-50s, in the 60s, as used for house paint. And we've been using alkyds, which are oil-based polyesters, which use vegetable oils. So that's a really nice green root raw material because it's, you know, literally, here's sunflower oil, modify this and use it as paint. Or here's linseed oil, or here's tung oil. And tung oil was a crop that was grown in Mississippi. Well, in about 1997, 98, Dr. Thames started trying to put vegetable oil pieces and parts tethered to acrylic backbones. So it's kind of the marrying of technologies. So he brought together acrylic paints with vegetable oil or alkyds, as a lot of people would call them, the oil-based paint lots of artists even use. He married those two, and it took probably, I'm going to say, 3 to 5 years to kind of sort out the process conditions to make that happen without having, you know, adverse chain transfer or differences in molecular weight and things like that. But once that started to come together, Dr. Thames actually started a company that made paint, and they made this self cross-linking latex paint that was zero VOC. And it's brilliant because you're really taking two completely different things and kind of saying, how do I chemically alter the structure of this to get both the ease of water cleanup, but then after the water's gone and it's formed the film, it can auto-oxidize and cross-link in situ and perform differently. You know, things I can remember the first time we proved that we had a tunable, controllable delta TG after application. So like you could make the delta TG through cross-link density and total content of the vegetable oil. You could make it 0 delta TG, or you could make it 5 degrees or 10 degrees or 17 degrees. Well, something really neat happened then, because then you could separate the TG of the starting polymer and the TG of the finished polymer with two different tunable variables. And so he was able to generate an entire technology platform, zero VOC. And there were times where, because of certain colorants and things, they might be 3 or 4 grams per liter. But in most of the world, 3 or 4 grams per liter of paint is still considered almost no VOC, almost okay. No detectable VOCs. Whereas, you know, at the time, alkyd paints would have been 450 grams per liter. And you think about how much is in a liter, you know, maybe 1,000 grams, right? So 450 grams was solvent. 650 grams was paint that you were going to get to keep after it went to the wall. So
basically half of that can would be gone by the time you paint your wall.
That was a typical 450 grams per liter would be a typical alkyd from the 70s and 80s.
Wow.
They're higher solids now. So they, you know, somewhere between 250 grams per liter and 125. But What his target was zero grams, nothing in here that you wouldn't let your baby touch or hold or have or that kind of thing. How safe can we be? How low odor can we be? And started a company called Southern Diversified Products and commercialized the technology. When September 11th happened, matter of fact, when the Pentagon was hit, the plane crashed into it, Dr. Timms, through some relationships with Senator Cochran and a few other people, actually was able to generate from this facility. I wasn't physically here for that, but as a school of polymer science and engineering, generated, I think, a little under 100 gallons of finished paint that went into the restoration at the Pentagon to let them paint while they still worked.
Yeah.
And it was low VOC, and it turned out that company became Southern Diversified Products, and then later it became Mythic Paint. My understanding of it is the technology was fabulous. And if anybody had ever used their ceiling paint, it didn't change colors like the one we talked about before. But what it did do is it was so well formulated that you didn't get any of the little dots all over you. Because a lot of people, when they run a roller, they're trying to do it quick because it's overhead and it's a lot of labor. So it had no splatter. And it's rare to find a ceiling paint that is that well tuned. And I know there's a couple folks that spent a lot of energy trying to make that the case, and they did good. My understanding is Mythic Paint they gambled everything they had on being the zero VOC, the low odor, kid-friendly paint, and they were leveraging to make that happen. And Target stores had intended to add a paint department. Mm-hmm. And at the last minute, after Mythic had put everything they had Target pulled out and said, "We just think it's too messy. We can't have paint in our stores."
Wow.
And they pulled out, and the company kind of just fell apart at that point. And financially, they just didn't have they didn't quite have that momentum.
So, right.
What's good, though, a lot of those folks are working at lots of other neat technology companies now. But even Behr Paint, Benjamin Moore, and Sherwin-Williams, PPG, lots of these companies now have those kind of lines of paint where you can go in and say, "I want low VOC, I want this, I want, you know, no odor." And so that's been a big transition over the last 20 years, is the friendliness for the atmosphere around you while you're painting.
Right, right.
And I want to say, the beauty of it is the coatings people, the scientists and engineers that developed those, knew from the get-go that you weren't going to sell somebody something green unless it performed as well as everything in the past and was green. It just, and I think this happens in a lot of industries, because people give, maybe the crude way to say it, people give lip service all the time to, "We're green," or "This is green," and "That's green." But there's often a higher price and a diminished performance. Mm-hmm. But what you'll find if you go, there's a particular line at Benjamin Moore called Advance. And if you use it, I mean, it is a phenomenally good product. And it's really, really low VOC. It's easy cleanup. It's a self-cross-linking system. It dries hard hard, chip-resistant, and tough as if you bought a piece of furniture from some OEM manufacturer and all you did was painted your baseboard. And like I said earlier, you're buying a gallon of paint, and in that case, it's probably $45 a gallon, right? It's color matched specifically to exactly what you tell them you want. Even if you bring in an old hairbrush from when you were 10 and you say, "I want to match this color. This is the raspberry color I want for my trim," or whatever it is. They get it really precise. They match it. They hand it to you. You go paint it. It performs well for, you know, a decade. And it's thousands of layers and layers of technology wrapped up into this liquid can. I mean, it's incredible. A gallon of well-made paint rivals a cell phone with the number of technologies you're bringing together. But people don't think of it that way.
Right, yeah.
You know, nobody buys a gallon of paint except maybe, you know, nerds like me and go, "This is high-tech in a can," right? But you buy a new iPhone or a new Galaxy, and you're like, "Wow, it's incredible the things it does." But it's pretty incredible what a gallon of paint will do.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I again, the way you phrase it, the tech that goes into that is incredible. And admittedly, before the class that we took, I didn't Not caring much about paint.
Most people never think twice about it.
And until they're part of, you know, maybe a Navy shipman whose forced labor punishment is go paint something, right?
Yeah. Well, Dr. Rollins, it's 1:59. I wanted to ask if there's maybe some kind of exciting project that you would be able to talk about that you're working on now. Whatever, how much time you have left, I'm not quite sure. I don't want to push too much there.
Yeah, I will mention one that's really exciting. And again, so I get it, nerds and geeks that think in these kind of technological terms. We're working on a replacement technology. We're making some new materials. But the replacement technology is to replace something that, as best we can tell, the first formulation reduced to practice and used is about 1951, 53, somewhere in there. You can actually find the original handwritten notes for the formulation. And it's used all over the U.S., probably all over the world, but it's specified as to be used in freshwater locks and dams and freshwater tributaries. Mm-hmm. And Army Corps of Engineers uses it. And it's an incredibly good performing technology. Unfortunately, it's almost 90% by weight solvent. The problem has been is for 3-4 decades now, they can't find something that performs similarly that doesn't have that much solvent. And we've spent the last 2 years measuring kind of in the background of that material and building different model systems of that material. We've been building versions of it to try to prove which part, which piece, which component, which aspect of each of the 7 or 8 components that are in there really does the performance hinge on. Mm-hmm. And what's really neat is, we often try to think in linear logic, like it must be this one. Well, no, it turns out it's the combination of 3 or 4 of them. And so once we quantified that, and the team here did a fabulous job at it, there's just lots of really important characterization methods and subtle things where we're watching it, even while it's drying, there's some things going on that matter. And they come down, for the polymer side of things, they come down to things like how fast do these materials try to get away from each other and phase separate, but how much does this solvent hold them together? And so there's some really unique morphologies that are developed. And you wouldn't think that. And no one would have spent any time studying this had there not been some really bright lead scientists that funded us that they've been looking at it and going, why does this last 30 years without fail? But we can't replace it with anything that lasts more than a year or two. And as you can imagine, locks and dams and freshwater, I mean, we've got to be really careful with everything we put in freshwater. We've got to be really careful that we protect the steel structures from corrosion. So it turned out that it lasted so long that it was worth really taking kind of a second look at how does it perform and why. And so we think we've peeled back enough of the layers of logic to understand the combined performance that we get. And now we're going to mimic it with a system that's low VOC. And so we're pretty excited about it. And that project just kicked off. It was officially funded on March 1st. March 1st, March 3rd of 2021.
Recently.
Yeah, so.
Very recently.
We're going to use all our synthesis and kind of architectural design knowledge to make something that can mimic it on a performance side, but not have to carry 90% by weight solvent with it when it goes. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's incredible. And how many, so you've got a few students on the way out.
I do, and I have 3. And all 3 of them are working in coatings related. And each of them has had a role in getting background data to support this project being funded.
Yeah.
And I've got 2 undergrads, both of them are graduating hopefully next week. And I've got 6 other full-time staff researchers. And every one of them has a kind of a special nuanced way of both studying things and measuring things, but then getting everybody else to get the best out of each other. So we've got a phenomenal team. We've been really, really blessed with kind of how we all happened to be here, serendipitously ended up at the same place at the same time. And we're lucky. We get paid to do what we do. So it's kind of nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, awesome, Dr. Rollins. If there's is there any last fun facts that you feel like adding?
I think probably just Sometimes you don't know where life's going to take you, and that's not so bad. And you definitely don't know where the data is going to take you, right? If you can predict in advance what the experimental outcome will be, you've probably have narrowed the variables down so small that they're no longer real. And so study real things. And I think it was Feynman that said that we wanted to study things that were hard, things that were difficult. And this is not an exact quote, but we wanted to study things that were so difficult, we didn't even know the right questions to ask. And I'll tell you, if you like to solve problems and you want to be in science, finding hard problems to solve, incrementally making them harder and harder, is absolutely the most fulfilling life you can have. It's fabulous.
Wonderful. Dr. Rollins, thank you again for speaking with me and being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jacob. Yeah. Have a great day.
That's all for today's episode of the Polymer Science Podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Please remember to share this episode and hit that subscribe button. Maybe even leave a review if you haven't done so already so that we can make this show even better. Your support goes a long way and is very much appreciated. If you have any suggestions, comments, or questions, please let us know by sending those to polymersciencepodcast@gmail.com. Stay safe, stay healthy. Until next time.